Yeah.
Yeah. How's it
That's
going?
It's a jazzy little tune.
It's jazzy, yeah. I haven't been drinking yet.
Oh, really?
Surprisingly, yeah. I just like this movie. It's a good movie.
Yes, I like this movie as well. Are you implying that you need to drink to get through our other movies?
A combination of the movies and just, you know, life. Sometimes alcohol helps, but this time I did need a drink, although this movie goes well with a nice pint of lager.
What was that noise?
It was my neck cracking. I was stretching.
Oh, okay.
It's important to limber up before you do vigorous activity like podcasting.
Uh-huh.
What's your pregame routine?
I make sure that I pour myself some water. I close the pocket door to the kitchen so you can't hear the refrigerator running. I close all the windows. I turn off the AC so that I can broil slowly for an hour to 2 hours. And I set up on the dining room table with the microphone rather than doing it at my desk, because if I sat at my desk, then you'd hear my chair because it squeaks. So I'm on the plush dining room chair. It doesn't make noises since it's plush.
Well, I only have the one chair here, as you probably noticed from the 90-something episodes that we've done, that all of them include my the creaking of my chair.
The creaking of your chair and whatever that clunk is whenever you put something down on top of whatever table surface it is.
No, that's the chair. That's the
chair?
Okay. It makes this plastic, like, clicking noise when I, like, shift my weight a little bit, like that.
Let's just say when I'm editing the shows, I'm not a fan.
Neither am I.
Sometimes it happens when you're in the middle of a word or something, and it's just like, I'm not going to do anything with that. That's staying.
Yeah, whenever I ever so slightly shift my weight, it creaks.
Yes.
And it's nice and warm in here, too. It's about to get a lot warmer, too. I just bought another gigantic Drobo to stick in my room to fill up with stupid footage of things.
Ah, Drobo or not.
Yeah. Another 25 terabytes to send up to the cloud with my back blaze.
That's cool. I don't have a Drobo don't tell anybody on the internet I said this, but I don't have a backblaze either.
You don't backblaze your stuff? Well, you don't really do anything with your computer other than podcast.
No, but I should back it up because, you know, photos and stuff, precious memories that I never look at. But
do you really
maybe
keep
someday.
It all in Dropbox?
Not the photos.
Oh, my God. What are you doing?
Those are backed up on my Time Machine locally and on my phone.
Because
nothing
ever goes wrong with Time Machine.
Yeah, but I'm
or
hoping...
a phone.
I'm hoping nothing bad happens to both at the same time, but, you know, that is the pitch for Backblaze, is, you know, you can never be too safe. And you could always run Backblaze crash plan, do your own offsite backups manually by taking drives over to somebody else's apartment or home. But I've realized that I have a certain risk factor to commitment ratio, and it is this. maybe I'll do the Backblaze. If only someone had some sort of a sponsorship code that I could use. They should pay us. That would be sweet. Hey, we're talking about you guys. Listen up right now to the
words
I'm saying.
They're probably angry at me for all the stuff that I upload to them, so they don't want to sponsor us.
They'll probably just charge me for all the stuff you upload.
Yeah, it's already a loss for them.
not gonna break even there. So this week...
Mm-hmm.
This week, we were like, hey, movies, speak to us. What do you say? And
we selected a movie that we've talked about doing before in the past, but we basically decided to put it on hold either when we were feeling better or when we could get a special guest for it or something, because it is a movie that many people feel very strongly about, as noted by the fact that when you tweeted that we would be recording it today, it was just a back and forth of quotes and gifts between various folks and them talking about how much they love it.
Yeah. We've mentioned this before, so you can go back and listen to our Scott Pilgrim versus the World episode and our Shaun of the Dead episode if you haven't already. I'll put them in the show notes, which are available.
Yeah, we did both of those already, didn't we?
Yes, yes. and those are available at one of those had a special guest, and that was Mr. Mike Hurley of Relay FM's. But
it was episode 7.
Yes,
remember back episode 7 when the show was still good. That was a back to work joke. Sorry.
That was That was for a certain part of our audience. But anyway, we have covered those in the past, and we have briefly mentioned Hot Fuzz because, as I've called out in those episodes, and I'll call out again, it is my favorite of the Cornetto trilogy, and it might be potentially my favorite Edgar Wright movie. I haven't seen everything he's ever done, but of what he's done, this is my favorite. I do like Scott Pilgrim versus the World a lot, but this, I like the total package of this movie better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we talked about it when we did Scott Pilgrim, that it has a little bit of a story problem with its disjointedness going from person to person to person while he's doing his battle stuff. And then Shaun of the Dead's great, but, you know, it's his first one. And this one, they really ramped it up, and he really started to come into his Edgar Wrightness in this one, which he double, tripled down on for World's End, which is also another great movie. But again, it's a little less fun than this one. That one has, you know, more seriousness to it.
I would say my enjoyment of Edgar Wright movies is strongly tied to whatever he does in the third act of his films. So sometimes he has third acts that I'm less fond of, but you know, first and second acts, which are great, etc. But if you fall off towards the end, it's make the movie bad. It's just not my favorite. And just being honest, keeping it real, you know, deal with it. But that's where we come down on this. Like, I own these because I love them enough to buy them. So it's of that level. So if anyone's listening and they're like, I don't think he actually likes this thing he's talking about, then you know what? Eat it. Because
I don't know,
I do.
Joe. This movie doesn't have any space in it. How can we ever trust that you actually like it?
Well, do you know who scored the film?
No, but I'm sure you're going to tell me.
David Arnold. Remember
sure.
him?
No.
No. Last week. Space movie last week. Wing Commander.
No, he did not.
Yes. And Stargate. Oh, and Independence Day. David Arnold, remember you were like, ah, he hasn't done anything good. I don't like him. And in all fairness, he didn't actually score the movie. He only did a theme for last week's Wing Commander. But I just wanted to point that one out for you.
Thank you. I appreciate mm-hmm. that. No, the music in this one is very appropriately campy and silly.
Well, but it's also got like an edge to it. Especially that like pounding bass thing that they go to for the like we're serious action theme for the character of Nick Angel, you know, played by Simon Pegg, and Danny Butterman, who played by Nick Frost. I almost mm-hmm. had them backwards because Nick Frost and Nick Angel, but whoopsie.
He's the Butterman.
Yes, I guess that's a mnemonic. But. This is a very interesting movie, too, in terms of execution, and it's another reason why I quite like it, because it is dense. It is incredibly dense, and not in like a bad, like, oh, what an awful textbook kind of a way, but in like
not dense in a George Lucas kind of way.
Yeah, no.
It's not really his words.
It's not really dense. George Lucas is kind of like a low-calorie pound cake, where it seems dense, and you don't have that much to really chew on, but it is not worth eating. And so this is much richer and nuanced and layered. So I quite enjoy this. Everything in here, especially in terms of the camera work and the editing, is just brilliant. And he is, Edgar Wright is well known for paying very close attention to this stuff. And he goes out of his way to construct these really intricate things for sort of mundane aspects to what characters are doing or how they're living their life. Like something like opening a door gets like a crash zoom that lasts for 1 second, and then we cut to something else. And, you know, he might do match cuts for things that aren't really important in terms of a horror element, but but it still winds up looking visually interesting. So you're more engaged with it than if it had been cut, let's say, a little more pedestrianly or normally. Like, this movie really sticks out in terms of, like, craftsmanship and paying attention.
Yeah, he's got in the opening montage bits too, where, you know, the whole sort of intro to Nick Angel is sort of montage, but the travel montage where you've got the, you know, they do the thing where like a car wipes the frame in a lot of movies, but it's usually just done on a cut, where he actually has like rotoed the car so it's wider in frame and it actually cuts across and then wipes different things and transitions from scene to scene. It's very, very intricately done. And, you know, in addition to the density and the attention to detail in the filmmaking, there's also in the writing of this too. It's the thing he's, you know, become sort of known for like in his style, where, you know, the small, you know, phrases and things that are referenced early on in the movie come back in a different fashion or form later in the movie and are reused and are cleverly brought back to the audience. And it's one of those ones that you know, pays off if you watch the movie more than once and you're paying attention to these intricate details, because you catch things that you wouldn't have necessarily known the first time around or didn't appreciate the first time around.
Yeah, this is definitely something that you will observe more on repeat viewings, all kinds of things that you had initially missed. Even if you've seen this like 3 or 4 or 5 times, just watch it again with a pair of fresh eyes and look at things like where the camera cuts from and to, how often he's cutting. Like, there's this one shot that I just noticed this time when I was watching it, where they wipe the frame and then there's 4 jump cuts in on zooming in on one of the hooded figures before he goes and kills the guy in the house, Mr. Merchant. And it's just like, why did you need 4 jump cuts? Like, it seems absurd, because it was only like a second. But it's really fascinating to sort of mentally deconstruct that as you see it. Now, you still enjoy the movie as you're watching it. It's not like when a director might just sort of carelessly move a camera around, fly it through a space, have the camera go over and through walls and things. This is not that sort of hey, look at me-ness to it. So I like this.
It's almost hidden, but it's used almost entirely for pacing and timing, and just works super duper well.
Yeah, and in terms of the writing, like you said, we've got Chekhov's tiny references where all this stuff builds. There's callbacks. There's recurring bits that occur, like with the swan, etc., where you just keep showing and mentioning something, and then it finally pays off with a big thing. You see, how often do you see the sea mine? So many times. And you've got this where it just sort of builds to it. And you even have stuff in the writing where I can't tell if he had the idea when he wrote it or if he had the idea when he was directing it, but you know what, whatever. But there's this shot where they're sitting and eating the Cornettos inside of the police car, and they're both very dejected. And Nick Frost is still trying to be a little upbeat, and Simon Pegg is just very, you know, brow furrowed, and he's thinking about the, you know, the killer's sentence over and over in his mind with the voiceover. Mm-hmm. And then he realizes what it is. Nick, and he says, "We got to get back to the station." Nick Frost is like, "Well, what's the matter, brain freeze?" And he says, "No, you know, I know it's brainwave. I know who did it." And then there's a cut to Nick Frost as he tries to finish the Cornetto really fast. And it's only like this tiny little brief thing, because you instantly know he has brain freeze because he just said brain freeze a second ago. Yep. So he sets up this little joke in this little loop. Like, you don't have to cut back to Simon Pegg saying, "Oh, what's the matter, brain freeze?" Because you did it the other way the first time. So I really like the way he constructed that. I don't know if that was in the writing or if that was in the when he was sitting there to shoot it, but it's brilliant stuff.
Yeah, it's spectacular. I mean, there's too much to talk about in this movie. Edgar Wright, it seems like every little bit of this is in his brain before he does anything, which is the way you would want to try and approach something like this. But, you know, I guess, you know, I have listened to a few of the behind the scenes things where he mentions that some of the stuff wasn't exactly the way he wanted it. You know, the kids in the little hoods or whatever who were apparently causing havoc around town, I guess they had a larger role initially in the script, or I assume they shot part of it too, and they got kind of windowed down in the final cut, which you know, doesn't really bother me too much. But if you look at the characters, you're kind of like, yeah, why are they there? They serve very little purpose. But for the most part, every bit of this seems like every, you know, every frame of it is expertly crafted, and he has it in his mind from the moment that he wrote this down on paper. And we're just watching this fantastical imagination of his play out on screen, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah, and one of the really nice things about this is that he also plays a little with genres here, which he does every other movie, but the ones that he picks for this are the police action movie genre. They even internally have the meta references to things that have influenced him, including Bad Boys 2 and Point Break. And they also talk about other kinds of films, but they also have things that are not mentioned specifically in there. There's sort of these Wes Craven-y slasher moments.
Oh, yeah.
There's which don't really have anything to do with police, but they're in there. And they're worked in really well. Like, it doesn't really like stick out, but you can tell it's Wes Craven-y like slasher movie kind of stuff going on. And then you see the influence of something like The Omen, where they're all chanting, or the chanting in the music as the top of the church is coming down to kill the guy. Like, that influence is there as well. So it's really interesting stuff, and I like how he plays with it. There's even things in terms of like sound cues where. I don't know if you caught this, but when the character of Frank turns around in slow motion after he shoots the chandelier thing down and there's the sparks flying everywhere, he makes this like ferocious grin as he's like fleeing the pub. And while he's doing that in slow motion, there is this like lion growl, like softly played over that, and it's mm-hmm. it's really fascinating. There's a little musical cut about, I can't remember what the fire song is, but it plays for like 4 seconds when Timothy Dalton drives by the scene of Merchant's murder. So he plays in terms of these layers of sound as well.
Yeah, there's a couple edits that I can't remember what it was cutting from now, but there's an audio, like there's like a smack noise or something, but it cuts to a clap where the head Butterman, the old guy Butterman, he's clapping and then, you know, starts his next little line of dialogue. I think it was when he's first given Simon Pegg the tour of the facility. But there's the audio cuts matched. There's the video cuts matched. There's so much good stuff in this. And did you ever? You probably not, because you hate him. Did you ever listen to that commentary with him and Tarantino? That it's on my Huff Duffer from a million years ago, but it's so good.
No.
it's a commentary for Hot Fuzz with Edgar Wright and Quentin Tarantino, and they go off a lot talking about references. Like, there's the other references, which again are sort of beyond me, but they're blatantly referenced in here when Danny's at the grocery store and he's looking at the Chuck Norris movie Silent Rage and Super Cop, Jackie Chan. You know, there's a lot of the Jackie Chan sort of like chase stuff in this too. They talk about those influences because, you know, Tarantino's a big 70s cinema guy too, and Edgar Wright's apparently got a lot of the 70s, 80s sort of iconic movies for him, which sort of lent themselves to the inspiration for this, which now this is like now the inspiration for people like us, because it's just so expertly put together. But there's a ton of great information in that podcast. We'll put it in the show notes. You should listen to it, even though you hate Tarantino, because they don't really talk a ton about this movie. They talk about sort of like filmmaking styles and sort of where they came from, just all kinds of crazy stuff. And it's super entertaining.
Okay. You just know. You know my feelings on the T-Man.
Yeah, he's relatively subdued comparatively.
He didn't have that many bumps of coke before he recorded that.
I can't attest to that. No, I can't. I couldn't be certain.
You wouldn't want to guess his coke level.
No, I wouldn't want to guess his coke level. I wouldn't want to stake my reputation on that.
Yep.
That's a good movie. It's a shame that we're talking about this, because we're going to miss so many parts of the movie that are every favorite thing that everyone loves.
Yeah, well, I don't really care. We're not. This is not a professional dissection and dissertation and thesis on Hot Fuzz. I don't know if you could tell from the 93 other episodes of this podcast, but we don't do that.
Except Wrath of Khan, which, you know, I think we got pretty in-depth on that one.
Oh, well, when you have an expert, you don't want to waste it. And when you have two experts, then why waste that? But neither of us are experts here today.
Yeah, there's too much. I mean, we could spend an hour and a half talking about any given sequence in this movie. I mean, just the opening. I love the opening shot of this movie, which I completely forgot about, which is just that incredibly long take of Simon Pegg walking in on the far side of the empty building and walking all the way up to the camera as we slowly push in, and then he whips out his badge and holds it right up to the camera to fill the frame to show, you know, Inspector Nicholas Angel.
Yep.
And there's a fun montage seeing all of his history of going to the Academy and how he's the best and all his awards and blah, 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 and how he's great.
Yeah, and one of the things that I find is interesting about this montage, you get immediately the sense of his shortcomings as a human being outside of the job and his commitment to the job. It's very economic that you get this communicated to you so quickly through this voiceover and the quick cutting. But there are a couple of these shots where they try to show the number of arrests, and rather than showing a montage of him arresting multiple people, they actually have a shot where they have overlaid several other shots of him arresting people into one shot, which lasts for like a couple seconds. So you get the sense that multiple people have been arrested without cutting to all of these individual shots. And it's just not something you typically see, because that sort of thing is visually confusing most of the time, but they're all just close-ups on handcuffs. So it's interesting, because it's another way you can compress internally within even this tiny little piece of information. And we go to his meeting where he is being sat down to be promoted by Martin Freeman. And he's
promoted in air quotes.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, because Martin Freeman, there are several good cameos in here, and Martin Freeman has one of them. You know, he has a much larger role in World's End, but in here he just gets to mumble under his breath things that he doesn't think that Simon Pegg's character will like very much to hear, and it's pretty funny. And he calls in the inspector, and it's Steve Coogan. And Steve Coogan also it plays an interesting role in that they're trying to convey that they just, you know, want the best for him, and that he wants to move on to do this stuff. And then they want to see the chief inspector, and he's like, oh no, you want me to get him down here? You want me to get him down here? And he's got his hand hovering over the phone, and then he, you know, turns over his shoulder and shouts. And Bill Nighy walks in immediately.
So great. I love that part. He's like, are you sure you really want me to call him all the way down here from his office? He's like, you sure? He's like, yeah, he just shouts through the door and he's right there. He's like, no, seriously. We knew you were going to protest this. You're making us all look bad, so get the hell out of here. Which is hilarious, because it's the most bureaucratic nonsense, because he's this super cop. And then, of course, the humorous spin on the whole thing is that he's too good, and everyone is sick of him making everyone look bad, so they're going to send him out into the country, where of course he won't be able to cause any trouble because there's nothing going on there. It's the safest village in the whole country, except it's totally not.
Yes. And before he actually goes out there, he goes to see his ex, and she works for the police force as well in the crime lab unit, and they are going over a crime scene somewhere else in London, and she is inside of a clean suit, kind of looking thing. I don't know the technical police term for it, but you know, it looks like a clean room suit. And so is everybody else in these white suits. You can't really tell them all apart. And you get some visual jokes from that where it's like, no, that's Bob. I'm over here. And then
does he look like somebody I'd be interested in? No, it's the guy next to him.
Dave. Hello.
Hello. His ex is Cate Blanchett too. She's uncredited, but that's her.
Yeah. I didn't know that the first 4 times I saw this, because I didn't actually read anything about it. But
well, it's 'cause you can't tell it all.
No, yeah, well, but it's also like one of the worst kept secrets that she's in here. But apparently, I can't remember what exactly that had to do with anything, but something to do with like having to pay her or something for having a credit or whatever. But Anyway, she's in it, and she's charming for a couple seconds. So that's nice. And you get the clear sense that the reason why they separated was because he's unable to turn off, and it is all about his job for him.
Yeah, because he's trying to explain how sad he is that he has to move away, and at the same time, he goes, hey, do you know that window was broken from the inside? And everyone goes, oh, and looks over? Because, of course, he's right.
Yeah, and then we cut from there, and he's got his peace lily, which she had talked about, his Japanese peace lily, and he's got that on a train, and he's heading out of town. And he arrives and makes his way to the place where he'll be staying, where they have arranged for him to stay.
It's called like the Swan Hotel or something, isn't it?
I think so.
It's Swan something, and of course, Swan.
Yeah, and you have the guy sleeping on the couch. I'm sorry, on the wing chair, and he walks in, and there's this sort of creepy tone to it. The old lady is looking down at her crossword puzzle. She he says, I'm here to check in. And she says, but you've always been here.
And I love that Shining-esque aspect to it.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, sorry. I thought you were my husband. Anyway.
Yeah. Whoopsie-daisy. And then she says, fascist. And there's that nice little exchange where... it's actually her shouting out a word that has to do with her crossword puzzle, and he says, you know, it's fascism. Then he shouts out hag back at her, and she's so startled. And he retorts that it's number three down. And so they have a nice little exchange, and you get a little flavor so far that things are a little off kilter in the lovely little Sanford area. He goes to his room, which is the castle suite, and it is unattractive as a room. He drops off his stuff, including his plant, and he goes to the pub. On his way to the pub, he passes all the hoodies hanging out by the fountain, and he makes his way indoors, and there is Nick Frost at the pub bar. There's all the kids in the background. There's the two owners, and they are chit-chatting, and they are very chummy and amiable, and he wants a cranberry juice, and so he has his cranberry juice, very similar to other characters that don't drink, that are very, you know, focused, and so there's that. You know, it's tart, just like him.
Is there one in particular you're thinking of, a cranberry juice drinking character?
I was thinking of The Departed. But
yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think The Departed was, what, like 3 years after this? And so I don't know.
Yeah, I want to say 2010.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was after this. It was not an influence on this movie.
And this is where the economy of his writing, where he starts dropping hints now that'll be picked up later, where he asked to borrow the newspaper. They said, oh, that's not our newspaper. This newspaper's not that great. You know, they reported my wife's age at 55, and she's actually 53. And, oh, isn't that funny? But that's totally going to come back in the third act and be a huge plot point.
It is. It is hilarious later. But
I also love, did you notice that, like, as soon as he walks in, you see Nick Frost, like, right in the foreground saying, like, pint of lager. And then, like, by the time he finishes, like, his hello, I'll have a cranberry juice, can I borrow your newspaper? Nick Frost is behind him again going, can I have a pint of lager? It's like,
yeah,
good Lord, you took two steps out of frame and just chugged that thing and you're right back where you were.
Well, he's got to get good and drunk in a couple minutes. and then he notices out of the corner of his eye, certain physical characteristics, what we call profiling, of some of the other bar patrons who are in the pub, and they appear to be of an age that would not allow them to order alcoholic beverages. And there's a few...
They're all drinking beer with straws.
Yeah, just a few close-ups of that. And so he marches over there, and he asks them for their birthdays, and there's some hilarious quick cuts of them going, and then, you know, you're 37? And he's like, yes! So...
like, of course, the one that you always see is when's your birthday? 1st of February. Which year? Every year. Out. And then the very last kid, he says, and squeaks so high pitched. He's just like, yeah, out.
Yeah. And they he clears out the whole thing because he talks to the owners, and they're like, oh, well, you know, better in here than out there. And he doesn't agree because it's law. And so he kicks them all out, and there's a completely empty pub, and they're so sour about it.
Anything else? He's like, no, I'm fine. Drinks his cranberry juice. Sitting there by
another
himself.
Another cranberry juice.
No, I'm all right.
So bitter. And so they close up the pub there. He walks out. He looks at the fountain and sees a little piece of graffiti and also the little plaque on the fountain with the names of people inside the town. Behind him, we have the police. Well, someone we don't know who is a police officer, but a person who we have just seen, which is Nick Frost. And he is trying to get into a car. And it's
stabbing the side of his car with his key, trying to get in.
It's not going so well. Simon Pegg says, "You're not actually going to drive, are you?"
I love the way he says no. No. Just is drunken. I have no idea what's going on. And he starts to stumble off. And then he goes back to looking at his plaque. And all you hear is squealing tires. And the car comes flying at him. And he dives and rolls out of the way. And the car smashes into the fountain there. And then he yanks him out and arrests him. And says, "Taking you to the station. By the way, which way is the station? Because I have no idea. He just got here." And he hauls him all the way down to the police station. On his way, of course, finding another one of the kids peeing on the side of the road. So he arrests him for public urination. And by the time he gets to the police station, he has two other children, one wearing a large cone on his head. And he meets the night watchman guy who is nobody tells me nothing twin brother. It's the other one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he just sends Danny on to his little cell 4 where he can go sleep it off. And he's like, "Oh, don't worry about him. He'll be here in the morning."
Yeah.
And then he writes up all his paperwork.
And with all the stamps and stuff, nice little tight little montage of that. And then he's back asleep, gets up.
Super cop montage of filling out paperwork, which is pretty great.
Well, I mean, he treats everything so seriously. Mm-hmm. Everything. It's not just the fun stuff.
Police work is serious business. It's not all about gunfights and car chases. It's about following the rules to the letter and ensuring that everyone is safe.
Yes.
Which, and, you know, kind of goes out the window in the third act of this movie. Mm-hmm.
Safety. Who needs that? He goes on a little morning jog. We get some nice little music and view of the town, and everybody in the town seems to know who he is, which would be ordinarily disarming, except that they seem to be a very tight-knit community, and they're very appreciative of having this new officer in town. He goes into work. He sees what he thinks is the same guy, but it is the crabby twin. He goes in to start his job and meets Frank with Jim Broadbent playing that role. He goes to check on the cell, and there's Nick Frost. And he's behind him because he's not in the cell and he's in his police uniform. And he's like, "What's the matter?" And the guy's gone. So there's that.
"Why are you dressed like a police officer?" "Because I am one."
Yeah.
Confusion. Then he says, "So you've met my son." It's like, "Oh yeah, that explains it. He's a terrible cop. He's a screw up, but he's the boss's son. So that's why he's here."
Yeah. And then he goes on the tour. Where we get many similar shots of mostly empty rooms from the same angle, which is nice. And then
I like that there's a hedgehog in the riot gear room.
I like that the evidence room's completely empty because they have no need to fill it with anything.
No.
Yeah.
So it's the statistically safest city in the entire country.
Yeah. And then he's introduced to the guy upstairs who does the neighborhood watch, and they seem very committed to their surveillance.
The Neighborhood Watch Alliance.
Yeah.
The NWA.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't at all hilarious for being synonymous with another organization.
Yeah.
It's a band.
Yeah.
Well, a group.
Okay.
I don't really play instruments. Can you call them a band if they don't play instruments?
I have no idea. I'm not really an expert.
We should do some follow-up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, there's the cake. Everyone has cake because, he lost his hat or something. And then he's going to have a stricter punishment for his indiscretion of driving drunk, which apparently will involve bringing ice cream to the station for the next month.
Yep. Chunky Monkey.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what's Chunky Monkey? I don't know. Is that like Rocky Road?
No, that's the Ben and Jerry's one with the banana and stuff.
Oh, there's banana in it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want that.
Well, how do you expect them to get the monkey in the ice cream, Dan? You gotta have bananas. You can't just lure monkeys into ice cream with you know, fruit and nuts. You got to use specifically bananas.
Well, in this metaphor, what part of the ice cream is represented by monkey?
Well, that's the chunks, Dan.
Right. Chunks of what?
Monkey.
It's not chunks of monkey. What is it?
It's what it says on the tin, Dan. They can't lie about this stuff. They can't possibly lie about that.
Sure. So no, am I to assume that Moose Tracks actually contains moose poop?
Oh, I just thought it was footprints. I guess that makes sense, too.
I mean, a footprint is nothing. A footprint is like the absence of dirt in the shape of a foot. How do you put absence of dirt in ice cream?
Well, it's absence of dirt if you look at it. Some people look at it as, you know, dirt with an absence in it. You know, it depends on, like, your outlook on life.
Oh, dirt half full, dirt half empty?
Mm-hmm.
Wait. No.
You know, a print and a misprint. So we move along to them going out on their first little mission, and
Wait, don't they go to lunch first? He meets the Andes and they go to lunch, don't they?
Oh yeah, and the Andes are very resentful.
You can't forget you've got a mustache, and he says, "I know." That's another one of the great ones.
Yeah, and there's Doris.
There's Doris.
She just constantly has very inappropriate sexual innuendo jokes that she likes to make. So she's charming. There's one that pays off much later in the film, but they have this whole thing going back and forth, like, "You ain't seen Bad Boys 2," and he's so surprised about it.
Mm.
Basically
all of this, once they get past the introductions, is Danny being enamored by Sergeant Angel and all of the action he's seen and how he loves his action movies and wishes he could see some real action in the city, even though Simon Pegg is adamant that it's not fun in games. Being stabbed was super unpleasant and he does not enjoy it, and routine police work is where it's at, man.
Yep. And your pen is your most important tool, but that comes later. Mm-hmm. They go to the local supermarket thing for reasons, you know, and they meet creepy Timothy Dalton. And they have the whole thing with the shoplifter and the, "Oh, you mothers," and, you know, that.
He sees the swan, but he has to let go of the swan because he's chasing the dude, and he takes the shortcut through the gardens and does the flips.
I love the tiny fences. I love them. The tiny fences.
Maybe that's what they actually look like there. You don't know.
Yeah, well,
have you explored a lot of backyards in England?
So you're saying that normalized in those gardens, these are normal fences, that a tiny fence would indeed be smaller than these fences.
All I'm saying is that millennials these days prefer to have tinier fences so they can spend more of their money on things like traveling.
Oh, so these fences are all in their parents' back garden.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They put their tiny garden fence in a friend or a parent's backyard, and then they're free to save their money and spend it on other things, like Cornetto or something.
Uh-huh. But then Nick Frost runs through all of them.
He smashes their dreams.
Yeah. They catch the guy, throws the spray paint, knocks him out in the field, takes him back in, and he's very upset that Timothy Dalton doesn't want to press charges. And Jim Broadbent says, "You know, don't worry. I'll take care of it. He'll get his just desserts." LOL. Totally not death.
Yeah.
Totally death.
Where it's starting to ever so slightly spiral for him. This town is a little bit off its rocker. The whole, there's no crime here. There's no crime at all. And then he's like, "Well, there is a crime. You guys are just not, like, doing anything about it." But then it goes away. What's going on here?
Yeah. Then they go out to investigate a call with the guy who cut down the hedge. and we get What's-His-Face and Saxon the dog, and Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, and the guy who was in Doctor Who and who played that janitor, Hurley or whatever, I can't remember his name, from the Harry Potter things. Harry Potter people, cool yourselves.
Yeah, those are two things that I've seen before.
Yeah. So anyway,
big Doctor Who fan.
He mumbles less in those other roles, but he mumbles a lot here. And he's translated partially by the other older police officer, who is translated partially by Nick Frost, who's finally heard by Simon Pegg. And they have this little relay back and forth. And then they come to find out that it's not just that one shotgun. There are more, because he has a permit for this one. And then in his shed, he has a whole bunch of things, including...
Which he found...
Yes, found all him. Of them he found.
Yeah,
and including a sea mine.
Of course, because as we learned earlier from the Andes at lunch, everyone and their mums is packing around here. Mm-hmm. Farmers and farmers' mums.
Yes,
I love the way all of these lines are just delivered so matter of factly. You know, that probably contributes to the fact that like that's why most people miss a lot of the subtlety behind some of this stuff, and the repeat views really work for you, but. Every one of these lines is so perfectly written, comes back again, and is just, it's a gold mine of delightfulness.
Yeah. And then there's a montage of them taking all of the guns and putting them into the evidence room, including the sea mine, which I don't think they should really have put there. Spoiler alert. And
we can't just leave it out there to blow up in the country. I mean, somebody could get hurt. That's a lawsuit waiting to happen.
Yeah, you should definitely have it in the middle of your... heart of your police station. They go out to celebrate, and they got the wine selection, and that turns out to be we got red and we got white. And then, you know, there's the whole conversation about I don't remember a time when I didn't want to be a police officer.
Didn't we also get the traffic stop with whatcha who's it, Martin and Eve?
Oh, I forgot to write that down.
Yeah, that was right before. So basically, they sped past. He uses his pen, his mightiest weapon, pull him over. What did he say? You brainwashed him or something? Hypnotized him?
Yes. And he says, no, I just used the most powerful thing. And then he says his pad, you know, to do that, because he kept writing down everything and stopped writing it down. The Martin seems weird. They have the whole thing about how he's, you know, very important. He's a solicitor and he's, you know, a lawyer basically. And he's going to go do the play thing. And he's, you know, Romeo and Juliet and blah, 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 an homage. He takes care of that situation. So I greatly appreciate that, because it will come back to be of some importance later. Because you need to know what kind of car they had. You need to know that they were reckless drivers, and you need to know that he was weird, and you need to know that there was a Romeo and Juliet play.
Yeah, they went and saw Romeo and Juliet, which was just dreadful. Just terrible, terrible, terrible.
Yeah, I like the part where it ends with, love me, love me.
That's so great. Who does that song?
Oh, I can't remember.
Is that the Cardigans?
Could be. But moving on, they...
Yeah, it was so bad afterward that they went and got drunk, right?
Yeah. They went to celebrate also his you know clever little turn of phrase. They walked off and Nick Frost is like, oh, you're so amazing, and Simon Pegg allows himself a little smile like, oh, I did okay.
Drive safe. You know, that's the guy we did for speeding earlier.
Yeah.
Like, yes, I get it. That's why I said it, to be kind of a sassy, jerky cop.
Oh, so nice. And they go to the pub and they get the red or the white, and you know. He just has a pint of lager. Meanwhile, back at the play place, horror shots and Wes Craven monster cams of going towards doors and, you know, over the shoulder stuff and people screaming and, you know, hatchets.
Shockingly
and blood.
Brutal footage of the guy getting his head cut off with an axe.
Yeah, what's really interesting is the amount of time that he focuses on that sort of gore. All the police stuff is relatively gore-free, really, where even like the end gunfight that goes on forever in the car chase and everything, there's like a couple little things of blood, but it's not like this, all of the other like murders that happen. All the murders are very gruesome, very graphic, very sort of like horror shock value, which makes them somewhat distinct.
I guess it makes sense that this is an R-rated movie. You can never tell anymore because they let cursing slide so much. But yeah, this is definitely R-rated.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a slippery slope once you start allowing S words.
Just slippery slope that
slippery slope
cause
of
you
S.
To fly up in the air and impale yourself. Mm-hmm. But that's later.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you should always take those kinds of criticism about your language and the church on the chin.
Not sure that that technically still qualifies as the chin. It's more like the lower jaw of a chair. It's close enough.
Dan, you got to work with me here.
Yeah, I'm working with you. I'm trying.
Okay. All right. So
I'm just clarifying for the audience that may not have gathered that that is a pun. Note for later, ladies and gentlemen, Joe is making a pun about a thing that happens later.
A play on words, ladies and gentlemen. A play on words.
Church on the chin is basically the moral of that. All right, we'll move past.
Yep. And so they celebrate and they take home Mr. Merchant, who we had previously heard introduced on the closed captioning footage in Timothy Dalton's resentment towards him because, oh, he has such an ugly house. And he's a refrigerator magnate in this town for some reason, and property developer. All of these things are somewhat important. One of them is more important than the others. And it is hilarious which one of them turns out to be more important. But we go to see them escort the peeing, too drunk Mr. Merchant back to his home. They take him into the doorway of his tacky place.
We skipped a little bit because he was getting super drunk because even Martin died and he was super sad. But yeah, that's the next morning they find the car after they've been cut off. Their heads have been cut off, like, on the side of the road. It appears that they lost control of their car on the way home from their play and went right underneath a sign that was only neck height and decapitated them, which I'm not entirely sure that's how cars with windshields work, but sure. It's brutal. And then there's the whole cleanup stuff and the hilariousness that ensues with how he's thinking about it deeply and then just, you know, spits out his rote cop story of how you're supposed to handle stuff like this. And then, oh no, they see Skinner driving by. And how creepy is that he's here and he knows who the people who died in the crash are.
Mm-hmm.
No, but yes, of course, later.
Where he gets around.
Yeah, later he's, Martin's, Martin? Martin. Merchant. Mr. Merchant mm-hmm. is drunk and peeing on the arcade machine because he thinks it's a urinal.
Yeah, and then they take him home. And Nick Frost makes a pun about, I was hoping we'd get a little drunk this evening, and because Mr. Merchant is slight of stature. And so they get drunk. So then they take him to the doorway of his house, dump him in there, close the door. They go back to Nick Frost's place.
Like throw him into his house.
Yeah, they go back to Nick Frost's place, and they're going to watch movies. And over at Mr. Merchant's place, there's someone inside the house. And he goes to pee all over his bathroom, and he has a beer, and he is murdered. And then they set it up to look like he was making himself a little snack of beans and bacon and some toast. And they set off the gas, and there's a giant explosion, and a flaming ball of something goes towards the camera. Yeah, and
a charred corpse comes flying out and hits the camera, which is a nice touch, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's laying it on a little thick, but it's interesting.
Well, we're in full-blown slasher flick at this point where everything is getting a little silly.
Yeah. And they're watching, what are they? They watch Point Break first, and then they fall asleep halfway through Bad Boys 2 because it's only the part where they do the spinny camera shot around him as he realizes that his sister's been abducted and flown to Cuba, and there's this whole other part of the movie that takes place after that.
Yeah, that's only 2.5 hours into Bad Boys 2, and then there's the remaining 35 minutes of Cuba.
Yeah, and then there's the bleep got real, you know, and they reference that later on.
So Circle it's Dolly also.
Yeah. It's important that you reference that because that is an important reference for references all the way down. And mm-hmm.
I would like to stipulate that I have never done a circle dolly in homage to that shot before. I certainly didn't do that like two projects ago on a thing too.
Oh, Dan,
circle dollies are great for drama.
So wait, did you do a circle dolly an homage to Hot Fuzz doing an homage to Bad Boys 2, or did you just skip back to the original? Was it a copy of a copy?
I'm going to say...
Have you seen Multiplicity?
Yes, I have seen Multiplicity. I watched that again not too long ago. It's actually really, really bad. It was on TV. It was really bad. I mostly wanted to see how the compositing worked, and not super well. But the generation loss on that stuff is so bad. It's so grainy and noisy. Ugh.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm going to go with reference to Hot Fuzz, specifically because Tarantino was on the commentary, because mine didn't involve guns, it involved swords, and he made Kill Bill. So there.
Whatever helped you sleep at night, Dan.
You know what would have helped me sleep is if we would have had a full 360 dolly track, but we could only set up 3/4 of it because we ran out of wedges and cribbing because we were on top of 2 feet of snow.
Damn.
It's a huge bummer. I really wanted to do a full 360 dolly, but we only got like a 270. That's incredibly disheartening.
It's funny.
These are legitimate problems.
Yes. 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 You didn't have the dolly you wanted. You had to make do with the dolly you had.
Well, I had the dolly. We just didn't have the track. Actually, okay. We might have had the track, too. We just didn't have the... Anyway.
You didn't have the track parts for that. Your train set was shorted some track parts.
Yeah. We were missing arbitrary pieces of wood that are used to level out the track.
Okay. Let's pivot from your missing wood back to Hot Fuzz, and they go in.
Those two things work surprisingly well together.
Yeah, don't they?
Gross.
And they go into the police station. There's been another accident, and they go investigate Mr. Merchant, who is a corpse, and outside of his house, because that was the flaming ball we saw flying through the air. And they... check this out, and everybody's like, oh, what a terrible accident. He was making breakfast, and it just exploded. A little midnight snack, too. Oh, LOL. They do the whole thing of, like, how should we take care of this? Well, cordon this off, do this, direct that. And sure enough, Timothy Dalton drives by again, and he's playing that little fire clip and smiling and waves. Coincidence? No.
That was a good impersonation of Drunk Danny.
Nick Frost is a treasure, because in every scene that he is in, he just like has the most perfect timing for the character that he's playing.
Yeah,
it is amazing.
Shaun of the Dead was on the other day, too, and both, I mean, Simon Pegg gets to do a lot of different stuff with his characters, and sometimes like you would almost feel like Nick Frost gets a little bit of the shaft with some of the characters he's playing, but he manages to transform every character he's playing and become so completely different that it's almost shocking, because, I mean, he's playing, like, basically regular dudes, but they're so dramatically different from movie to movie. He's just awesome.
Yeah, and he does a lot of stuff with physical comedy, especially when he starts sort of running around in the rain later on. He does this little jog back and forth as he goes into the distance with the teddy bear. Anyway, I die every time I see that. Back to this moment. They check that out, and Nick Angel is starting to get awfully suspicious, you know, of things and stuff.
All of these people who kind of sort of know each other are dying, and it all seems like accidents, but it's not necessarily accidents. He has suspicions.
Yeah.
Mr. Skinner.
Mm-hmm. But they haven't used the M word yet. Mm-hmm. And so they go off to the local fair, and Tim Messenger, the annoying newspaper editor and journalist, is there, the Sanford Citizen newspaper. He approaches Nick and claims to have information regarding Merchant and requests to meet him alone in the churchyard at 3 o'clock. Now, most of that I just read from Wikipedia, except for the at 3 o'clock. I don't know why they didn't put that in there. That's important. Wikipedia should really have that in there. And then Simon Pegg goes up and he starts drawing things out and announcing names. And, of course, he announces Tim Messenger's name, but he's not there.
And neither is Mr. Skinner. It was the other name.
Yeah, and he has this ominous feeling about it, and he runs around the back of the church just in time to see the church spire fall down, and you see really see the church fire in his neck. And
how ridiculous and gross is that?
His whole head explodes, which is kind of funny because Nick Frost had earlier asked him, is it true that there's a spot in a man's head where you shoot it and his whole head explodes?
Turns out all you have to do is drop a bunch of concrete on it.
Yeah, well, you just drop a stone spire on top of somebody's head. And so he's dead. And Simon Pegg runs up the stairs, checks it out, and there's nothing there. He runs back down the stairs into Jim Broadbent. And he's like, it's murder. And Jim Broadbent, in his sheriff outfit, his little Old West sheriff outfit, just takes a step forward into it. And he's like, okay, you know what you need to do. Cordon this off, do this thing, and he starts rattling off orders for everybody, and then they're standing around in the rain doing the crime scene stuff, and the Andes are really ticked off because they should have been at the pub, and they're leaving, and Nick Frost is like, you know, it's true, you don't know how to turn off, and then he does this little runaway in the rain with the thing, and he's just squeaking.
Everyone's annoyed at him that he's so gung-ho about murder and he just won't let it drop and yelling at everyone for not doing their job. So he's starting to fracture the friendship with all of these people. Well, he hasn't really made friends with a lot of these people, but he's losing the one friend he has. The little boy who looks up to him with the stuffed monkey.
Oh, that's so funny.
I love that. You and your monkey. Did he mean me or that? And he held up the stuffed monkey.
Because he was holding it out of frame, so then he just takes it up just high enough that you see the stuffed monkey that he had won earlier. And we have the reference about how he doesn't use handguns anymore. We missed the little air rifle thing where he won the monkey. But anyway.
Just like the rundown. He's so good with guns and he's so brutal with what he can do that he doesn't like to use them anymore.
I kind of want to know. If Edgar Wright has seen the rundown.
Of course he has.
Oh man, I hope so. Like we said when we did that episode, I love the rundown. But because it is,
although I feel like there's another
stupid
movie from the 70s that came from.
The rundown.
I'm gonna listen. No. The no guns because I'm too much of a badass thing.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm gonna have to listen to that commentary.
It's a pretty big trope as far as I'm aware. Like I think I have the feeling that I've seen it a lot, but I don't actually have any factual knowledge of whether or not I've seen it as many times as I might think.
I mean, it's kind of a Chuck Norris thing too, right? He doesn't really use guns.
Yeah, I suppose.
He just has those jeans with the stretchy crotch so he can kick people in the face.
Yeah, well, those you should really buy a pair of those, Dan. And, you know, instead of sweatpants, and then you'd be all set.
Honestly, I think that was probably the inspiration for the modern jogger pant. It's just that sort of like flexible crotch stretchiness so you can kick real high.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's quote-unquote athletic wear.
I thought it was for jogging. Oh, do they just call it a jogger to throw you off the trail? That way you don't know that it's really for kicking? Because they called it the kicker. Then it would be a little too obvious. And then people might think that it was something they should ban. But if they call it the jogger, then you can't ban jogging. The jogging's so safe and totally not going to get you kicked. But if they call it the kicker, totally going to get you kicked. So this is a way to sneak that product out into the market.
I absolutely agree because, I mean, what really is the difference between jogging and kicking? They both involve moving your legs at a rapid pace in larger than normal strides. Just, you know, you keep one foot planted and you kick that other leg up to the head.
Yeah. I mean, that could just as easily be a very, very big step you're taking.
Very big step. I'm going to step very quickly onto your face.
Yes. Face stepping.
Anatomy of a kick.
So as you're doing your face jog, back to this movie, he goes back
he gets back to his hotel room and then he's all like wet and sad and the monkey's there.
Yeah, with the little note that it was left for him. And you know, he is all sad. Because he's losing the friend that he has. And so the next morning he starts to piece together something in the paper. Like the Andes didn't want to check every single newspaper, so he's going to check every single newspaper. And he starts circling things that are misspelled and seeing all the elements that could tie together.
Maybe there's some hidden code here in the misspelled words, which totally not. He's just an idiot.
Yeah. Unfortunate. And so he goes into the police station, and he sells all this stuff to Nick Frost, and he apologizes, and he's like, we've got the case, and, you know, we're back together, and so they go off and do their thing, and then they get back to the as they run the course of all the things that they're doing. They go back to the station. And
great walk and talk montage, cutting from all the locations you've seen before. The field where they're looking for the swan, the car where they were parked, looking at Mr. Treacher with his big jacket. All the different places.
Yeah. All the great places.
All the great places.
So they get back to the police station, and there's a cake, because it's actually his birthday. And he didn't tell him because they were having so much fun working. So Danny's got a cake that looks like a police hat with a little sparkler on top. And he's going to blow that out. And then he's like, I got to run out of here. I got a personal errand. And so Nick Angel blasts out of there and goes to the florist. She lets him in. And then he's like, oh, do you have any Japanese peace lilies? And he notices there's a, you know, everything must go, closing down the shop sign on the glass. And so he asks her about that as he's checking out the peace lily. And she explains, you know, oh, God rest his soul. I was going to, you know, sell this place to Mr. Merchant. And then God bless him. This, you know, she was going to file the paperwork. And God bless him. Messenger was telling me about how much it was worth, et cetera. And
this is the exposition bomb, which you kind of sort of already anticipate is totally not entirely accurate, but it's like, turns out all these dead people, not only did they know each other, but they knew that there was going to be a giant bypass coming through here, so they were buying up land that would be very valuable as soon as that happened, and they were going to, you know, make a ton of money off of putting in retail shops and stuff, which would shut down all the local stuff. But they realize, uh-oh, there's somebody behind us. It's got to be Skinner because he's the local business owner and he's killing everybody. And he left his pad in the car, of course.
It's Cousin Sissy.
Cousin Sissy, right.
Yeah, and so and she's about to say he can go, and then they cut cleverly away to him saying he needs to go get his pad. And as he heads on out of there, we see behind him in the shop that there is a hooded figure, and it takes those shears that she was just using, which seem ridiculously oversized for cutting ribbon, and stabs her in the chest.
Well, she said she can't. She always loses her scissors, so that's why she's using it.
Oh, I forgot. She's very graphically stabbed. And there's a little blood spurt, Angel turns around just in time to see that happening. See the hooded figure. He breaks in through the glass with his police baton. Maybe wasn't totally going to be dead if he probably, you know, put some pressure on the wound. But anyway, he's running after her.
She's totally dead. There's like a 12-inch metal spike going through her throat.
It just didn't seem super final. I mean, but he didn't really even try. He just runs off after the hooded figure, and then the hooded figure made it a really long distance away. And so he runs after the hooded figure through a little greenhouse, and there's a broken piece of glass, and it cuts the person on the shin. And there's some blood there. The person gets away though. Simon Pegg goes back to the police station, and he explains the whole thing that she's dead. And they go out and they check out the scene, and
the swear jar too.
Yes. So much swearing. And they keep putting stuff in to fix the church roof. And they have their little discussion about the back and forth that's occurred. The Andes don't believe that anybody's actually been killed. And he's like, you really think that she just tripped and fell on her shears? And they finally go around and he starts shouting murder, and it's like, murder. And then he says that he knows who did it, and that it was going to be cousin Sissy, who is Timothy Dalton. And they apparently called him that because he took dance classes. But
it was a ballet, is that what he said?
Yeah, ballet. Which, you know, it's just not very nice. It's Timothy Dalton. You know, he can do whatever he wants. So they go in to bust Timothy Dalton, all the police force. Jim Broadbent is there as well. And Simon Pegg leads the whole thing of explaining every detail of why they're in there and why they think it was him, and, you know, how he wasn't around, and how he showed up conveniently at these crime scenes, and about how he knew that this was all about the land development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The whole conspiracy theory that he pieced together from the events that have occurred so far in this movie, and his attempt to tie together all of these murders into one cohesive string of things. Unfortunately, he goes to check the shins of Mr. Skinner, and he has totally fine, normal shins, only, you know, he's got those little sock brace things.
so ridiculous looking.
Yeah, but his shins are fine otherwise. And so
because
that's...
Because, of course, when somebody ran out of Leslie Tiller's place, they, like, dove through, like, a... Was it, like, a... what do you call the glass place where they grow plants?
Greenhouse?
Greenhouse, dove through the wall of a greenhouse and cut themselves, and there was blood and stuff. Although, you know, you would think modern police force maybe like go collect that glass and run a DNA test on it or something. But no, they don't have forensics there, really.
Well, he talks about the crime scene investigation several times, although we don't really like have that occur on screen. So maybe they don't actually have that in a capacity that's very good.
Didn't the Andes, like, didn't their door say CSI on it? Like, are they also the crime scene investigation people?
Oh, I just thought they were the detectives.
Yeah, they are, but, like, I swear their door, when, like, it swung open in the very beginning, it said CSI on it, which would be hilariously depressing.
Yeah. So they are all very sad at this turn of events, and they also get the tape, which acts as an alibi for where Skinner was, because it's the security footage of them inside of the place, and Skinner has this lovely shot of his bleep-eating grin next to the photo of him grinning.
It's
exactly
pretty great.
The same. I love that shot. It is so good. And
feel free to spool through. Smile.
Yes. So nice. And they, he checks the tape and is escorted off the property. This is... The part where he's back to square one, trying to piece together what's happened, and he's just really not sure how all of these things are related. He can't really focus his mind around what it could be. And Angel is finally convinced, as they sit there dejected eating Cornetto, that he knows that it's multiple killers.
Oh yeah, because they do the callback thing again, where they go into the shop and the no luck catching them swans. Actually, it's just the one swan, and no luck catching them killers. Actually, it's just the one killer. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "Oh my god, maybe it's all of them working together." And he goes, and of course, pitches that to the head butterman,
Frank.
Frank Butterman is like, "Dude, you gotta calm down. You're freaking out. I know you're from a big city where this kind of crap happens, but we live out here in the country. It's not that big a deal. Take the day off." Relax, go take a nap. If you feel like you're still super jazzed up about investigating all these people tomorrow, then we'll start to look into it or whatever. But I think you're just like off the deep end.
Yeah, like Sergeant Popwell, he couldn't take it before you.
Yeah, great big bushy beard.
Yeah, and so he goes back to his place.
He could use the walk. So, you know, there's plenty of time to, you know, call ahead or anything like that. Whatever somebody may need to do.
Yeah, and he opens up the door, and sure enough, there's a hooded figure inside of there. And they fight each other, and the hood is peeled back, and it is revealed to be the guy who worked as the assistant managing at the grocery store,
Lurch / Michael.
Yes, who is a little who is portrayed in a somewhat limited vocabulary and form of speech, and that it is implied that his mother and sister are. The same person. So
it's not implied. It's stated.
It's stated.
Yeah, he can say only yarp and narp apparently.
Mm-hmm.
There's of course the wonderful moment where he distracts him with the cuddly monkey and then says playtime's over and hits him with the peace lily and knocks him out. And then Skinner's on the radio saying is Sergeant Angel knocked out? Is taken care of? And he pretends to be Michael on the radio saying yarp and narp. He said, "All right, good job. Meet us at the church."
What's funny about that is that he hasn't heard him say no before, so he doesn't know if it is NARP. So there's that tension and hesitation, and as he slowly says it, and then it like washes over his face when he's relieved that it's accepted. And so he goes off after the situation, but he goes to open the door, and lo and behold, there's Nick Frost, and he. You know, explains to him that he's out of there to do this thing and to watch Lurch, who's knocked out unconscious. And Nick Frost says, "Don't forget this memo pad's the most important," and he tucks it right into his front pocket there. That's important. Chekhov's notepad. And so they they go over to him going through, they go, Nick Angel going through the area. There's the chanting and the hooded figures all gathered around the stone table. And it all seems very cultish, omen-esque, whatever. You see all the faces of all the people in the town, and you cut to each, Nick Angel seeing each one of them. Now, Frank is not there, but basically everyone else in the town is, except for the other police officers. And this is, then the meeting starts, and there's a brief exchange about the christening, and they're all invited to attend. So it just lets you know that something is just, like, a little off kilter. Like, it's like evil, but it's, like, weird evil. Like, this is not, like, just, like, through and through, like, you know, we're horrible murderers who are intent on murdering. It's like, our focus is really on the community.
Mm-hmm.
That is our primary goal.
The murder of a police officer is item 2 on their agenda after the christening of some twins.
Yes, and it is funny that he's finally been taken care of. The tenacious sergeant's finally taken care of.
Now they can focus on their hoodie problem, which is again another one of those areas that's like, we never fully explain it other than that there are these school kids running around with hoods on. They like the spray paint on stuff.
Yeah. Also, they just don't like the look of them. They just seem like they're up to no good.
It's a little bit of a problem in their plan. If they kill all of the young children in the village, not really going to be much of a village in, you know, 10 years.
I don't really know if they have a long-term plan for that. Maybe they're hoping that people just retire there because it is so tranquil and free of hoodies, as they say.
Come to Sanford. We don't have any children here.
No annoying kids. Well, I mean, most of the townsfolk is pretty—they're pretty old, and they are surprised when the detective, sergeant, Nick Angel, comes out of there and he confronts all of them that he knows what they've done, and then he starts asking them about why they did it, and they say it was for the greater good. The greater good. And it still cracks me up. And they run through the whole list of why every single person was murdered. And it's not really like, well, it's not what anyone really had thought, because it doesn't really make much sense for killing someone, but
it's hilariously superficial. It's like, yeah, well, he had an ugly house and she had an annoying laugh and he was a really bad actor and we didn't want him tarnishing our town's reputation because we had 2 semi-professionals who were waiting, but they couldn't because he already had the role, and really they all just had to go because they were embarrassing.
Yeah, and there was the newspaper journalist who had all those horrible errors and
typos, and he writes tabloid journalism because the whole movie he's been asking people things like, "What's your perfect Sunday?" Or what was his you know, when they was taking the photo, talking to the school kids,
he wanted to put the teacher in cuffs. He wanted him to put the police hat on the other kid. He wanted him to wave his baton around. He wanted he's just silly.
Yeah, after the play, what did he say after the play? Something like, police sergeant enjoys watching teenage suicide or something.
I don't remember what that was, but yeah, it was something ridiculous. It was a bit of a leading question. And then as for why they killed, the florist, it's because if they can't have her, nobody can. And, you know, it would be terrible if Buford Abbey got her talents and then they would be better than us, so she can't go anywhere.
Yeah, if we can't have her, nobody can, which is like the worst justification for anything ever.
Yeah, but they're so focused on the purpose of the town.
Gotta win that award, man, because remember, you know, we're the best village, and that's of course when Frank shows up and explains why it's so important.
Yes, crusty jugglers.
Crusty jugglers.
Yeah, because they had moved in on the outside of town, and his wife had put them up for the first ever best town of the year competition, and they failed because these people moved in on the outskirts of town, or at least that's the reason why he thinks they failed. And so she went a little loopy, and in a fit of pique, drove off into the Sanford Gorge and killed herself.
By the way, not a very hilly village. So I love that Sanford Gorge is kind of just like a wink to like, no, there's no gorge.
No, yeah, there's. I certainly don't see it on the model. And so they...
That's the other great thing, like this whole time. As soon as he drives into town, you see the big sign for Model Village, which, of course, is an actual model village, like a very small-scale model. But, of course, it's also because they are the Model Village. Hilarious. Yes.
It's a play on words.
It's a play on... That's why you like Edgar Wright so much, his ability to play on words and things.
Yeah, it's a homage to Romeo and Juliet on words. So they... They kill all these people right now, basically, because their deaths will clean out the town for when the committee comes through to judge them tomorrow. That's when they'll be judged on Best Town of the Year again. And they want to win again because they've won, 20 other times? 20 other years?
Because this is the best village.
Yes, and it's for the greater good. And so they have... Nick Angel surrounded, and they all take out their weapons. And then behind him is Lurch, and that's a surprise because wasn't. Oh no, it's Nick Frost, treachery. There's that whole moment of Simon Pegg, you know, grabbing Nick Frost with the knife, and he's like, "I'll get him if you don't let me out of here." And they're like, "We know you won't do that." And so then he's like, "You're right," and then he dumps him, runs out and falls into some sort of loose floorboard in the field area there.
It falls into the catacombs underneath the city there.
Yeah, and then into the camper where there are skeletons of some family, presumably the Krusty Juggler family. And there's also the dead teens, and he stumbles through and sees the living statue that everyone objected so heavily about. And there's the guy who robbed the store who got his just desserts. There's one of the other hooded fellows, and they basically just cleaned out.
Yeah, the kid who stole the cookies. There's the great big bushy beard.
Yes, Sergeant Popwell, who allegedly went crazy and had to be taken out of the town. He was taken out of the town in a way. He basically stumbles across this whole area of the place where they've been hiding all the dead bodies that aren't set up to be accidents, the people that are just disappeared, which is curious, the number of people that are just disappeared and nobody comes looking for them, but I assume they check on that beforehand. Because I guess the guy that was in the tracksuit who robbed the store, that he might maybe have some sort of family in the local township, but maybe not.
Because when they arrest him, Danny says like, "Oh, I recognize him now that I can see his face." He said it's so and so's sister's brother's something or other.
Yeah, because he's ugly.
But as Danny explains, you know, the NWA has done a good job of basically making it appear as if they're wrapping them on the knuckles and sending them on their way. Get out of our town if you're going to be that kind of person, which apparently applies to like 15-year-olds too.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, no, they're all dead. So Nick Frost is pretty gullible about this whole thing. And there's the stabbing that occurs where betrayal again, treachery, and only it's the stab through the notepad, which is all ketchup because it's a callback to the ketchup murder that he did earlier. With his eyeball. No, don't worry, it's just ketchup. He takes Simon Pegg in his car out of town. We see them drive past the sign, and then they park out there, and then it's lit by the brake lights as they have their little discussion.
He does his homage to Tarantino here with the opening of the trunk, looking up by the red, and then you see, cut back down, you see Simon Pegg laying in there, eyes wide open. You can't tell if he's dead or not, but he's not dead. He just pops up and says, "What is going on? We have to go back in there and stop him."
Yeah, and Nick Frost is like, "I had to come up with my dad, you know, blah, 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 blah. You can go back to London. You can get out of here." So there's this sad little exchange. And then, you know, Nick Angel gets in the car, and he goes off, and in the rearview mirror, you see the brake lights fade across Nick Frost as he's driving away. So that's a nice little shot. And then he goes to the little gas service station pays for the gas, and then also sees the display of DVDs available for purchase. And right there in the center of the DVD rack, next to each other, it's Bad Boys 2 and Point Break.
And then this is when everything snaps and spirals, and he turns into Batman, and he starts talking with the gravelly voice. No, this is something I have to do myself. He goes and gets all the spray paint. He gets the sunglasses, because you got to have sunglasses if you're going to be a badass cop.
Yeah, and he's all geared up, and he drives back into town with this. And it's the morning when he gets back. And it's the one old guy who I don't remember the name of, has this little Jeep thing, and he's out on the edge of town. And his wife is over there behind some wall, and there's a horse. Horse is important. So he smashes his little VW car somehow into the Jeep hard enough that it knocks the Jeep down the road, which I find implausible. And
it's the movie has officially pivoted into Bad Boys 2. It's everything that Nick Frost through this entire movie has been saying is not what actual police work is about. But now it's about to become the ridiculous nonsense that he originally poo-pooed, but now it's just embracing it full board, becoming the super cop.
Yeah, and so they have their exchange, and you know, he's got the old guy, and the old lady tries to take shots at him, and he does this flying kick to her face, and then
it's so good. He goes running at her. It's the montage of her trying to reload the shotgun before he gets there, and she pulls up the shotgun just at the right time, but he flies through the air and kicks her right in the face. She's like 90 years old and gets double booted right in the face.
Oh, it's also sad too when you cut back to her later and she's got all that blood makeup on her nose for that, and they're all handcuffed to the fence thing there, and he's gonna go into the town now.
He's like, what are you gonna do, just drive into town and arrest everybody? And he says, not exactly, because of course he's gonna take the white horse in.
Yeah, so he takes the white horse in. He goes to the police station. He picks up a couple of things from the evidence room, all the guns that were confiscated from the loopy old man's place. And he does this under Jim Broadbent's nose as he's reading his newspaper in his office.
It's so great. Like, every one of these shots, like, he walks past the guy reading at the front there. He goes into the locker room where everyone's standing in the corner talking and joking and gets dressed. Because, again, nobody's paying attention. Because why would they? Because there's nothing serious. He goes into the evidence room, stocks up on all of the guns. Like, well, two shotguns, a bunch of pistols, assault rifle, all kinds of nonsense. And then heading out to go do battle. And then, of course, some people from London called you, and he turns around and just stares. He's like, eh, you look a little busy. I'll have him call you back.
Yeah, with the toothpick.
Yeah. And as soon as he kicks the door open, you hear the horse whinny. And then he goes, huh, I didn't know he had a mounted division. And then his twin is there with his signature line, nobody tells me nothing.
Yes. And this is the only time you see the two of them. The first time you see the two of them in the same shot together. Because beforehand, it wasn't entirely clear if it was the same guy or if it were was twins switching back and forth. And so he goes into town on his horse, and Nick Frost is inside of a police car just hanging out in the little town square. There's the fountain in the middle, and there's all the different shops and pubs and everything all around. There's the doctor. There's the guy with the suspicious coat, who Simon Pegg has suspected this entire time of carrying and packing heat.
Mr. Treacher.
Yes, Mr. Treacher. And there's just basically almost everyone. And this is when Simon Pegg makes his presence known. He pats the little horse on the butt and it goes off. And then Mr. Treacher takes a shot at him with the rifle that he's been carrying this whole entire time. And then everybody starts taking shots at him.
It's such a great entrance into, like, a, you know, showdown at the OK Corral kind of thing, because as he's riding in slowly on top of this giant white horse with the clopping footsteps, you just see slow dolly push-ins to every person as they turn around and go, oh crap. He's got all of his guns. And then of course there's the other callback, Sergeant Angel's back, take a look at his horse, which previously was the English word for butt. I don't know if we're allowed to say that on a podcast.
Butt?
Arse.
Oh.
Get a look at his arse.
Well, we don't have to bleep it if it's not a real word. Oh, so okay. the The thing is...
Arse, horse, they sound similar. Callback. It worked well.
Okay.
It made me laugh.
Okay. So they have the shootout, and he sends the little kids who he had tasked with spray painting all the things up the into the shop where there was that big sign that said, you know, only one school kid at a time. And they go and they take out the lady upstairs with the gun, which seems rather irresponsible of him.
Very irresponsible, but he got pinned down pretty quickly. He was taking fire from like three or four different sides all at once, and she was behind the line up in an elevated position shooting down at him, so he was really kind of screwed if she was still there.
Well, he still had a chance because none of the shots that she took were with the sight on the rifle she was holding, which is important for operating that sort of instrument, I would believe. She's just sort of like holding it out away from her, just firing willy-nilly.
She probably didn't have her right glasses on for that anyway, so.
No, I would imagine not. She wasn't totally prepared for this. The lady on the bike pulls out between on either side of her little thermos thing, there's foam and the little handguns.
I love that it's just perfectly cut out foam for her handguns.
Yeah, and they all start shooting in stuff, and everything's just going like total bonkers. He blows up the tire, which knocks the kegs, and that knocks out Treacher. Nick Frost opens the door, which knocks out the lady on the bike. Then they get pinned down by the doctor, and they go to drop the gun, and they drop the gun, and it blows the shell that he just released out of the chamber, and shoots him in the foot. Again, call back to the air rifle being shot in the foot, and you know, he's a doctor, he can deal with it. And there's the old lady who runs the inn, who he shoots the planter, and it falls down on her head after she calls him a fascist. There's
the husband and wife that own the bar that are hiding behind the thing. He tags them both in the shoulder.
Yes, and then there's the priest. He says, you know, it's mindless violence. You can tell that there's something up his sleeve. Presto, change-o. And there's guns. And he's shooting at him. And, you know, Nick Frost, you know, shoots. And they're shooting. And people are shot. And things. and then they go into the pub. Now that they have the couple pinned down, and there's
don't forget this is a circle dolly, by the way. This is a circle dolly. What, after they shoot the doctor and they stand up, what do you think? Pub, and Nick Frost puts on his sunglasses too, which apparently manifested out of nowhere because, you know, super cop. And then the circle dolly says, what are you thinking? Pub, which is their line from earlier every time they go to the pub. And now they do their diving through the air with the two guns shooting at the
tactically the unsound.
Tactically unsound, just dive through the air with two guns firing and then land on the ground and hide behind a wooden table that is having bullet holes shot through it. But, you know, battle now.
It's not IKEA, you know, MDF or anything, but I don't think that it would necessarily stand up to the kind of things that are being fired. But who knows? And they, you know, shoot the little bear trap that's some sort of decorative bear trap, and it falls and nails the guy. And then she's all freaking out.
You have a decorative bear trap above your bar.
Yeah, and then in comes Jim Broadbent in the front, and then the police officers, all in their riot gear, come in behind them, and so they're totally flanked and outgunned and outmaneuvered, and you know, now they're gonna get it. And Jim Broadbent, you know, wants his son to step away, and they're like, no, it's all, you know, you've all been brainwashed into this. You think this is normal? You think that there's nobody who gets murdered, but there's all these accidents that happen? Blah, blah, blah. And then as he wins over each of the officers, you can tell the moment they get won over by when they push up their little visor. And that's when they start questioning the chief of police. Before then, they're on the chief of police's side. And then eventually they're just like, hey, so this is really suspicious now. He has kind of a good point since you want us to shoot him so badly. Jim Broadbent calls them all incompetent Blackfoots, and then he shoots up the little chandelier thing, and it goes down into and there's a rain of sparks, and there's the like growl as he exits the building.
It's pretty great. Now, is this the time, or did I miss the time earlier? Was it at the church round table where they're all in their hoods, where Frank literally says that their whole goal is to make Sanford great again, which I could not stop laughing when I heard him say it this time, because he's just, he's the Donald Trump of Sanford.
Oh, I think he's ever so slightly more competent.
But yeah, it's just the lunacy of his plan in the name of making Sanford great again.
Yeah, not to get political, but so they go out of there, and instead of chasing after Jim Broadbent, they decide to go to the shop. This, of course, is the little shopping center that's run by Timothy Dalton. And inside are all of his henchpeople, who apparently don't just work there, but also work for him in evil capacity. Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets a little, like, video gamey, in that you're sort of, like, taking down all the mini-bosses before you go fight the big boss. And
there's also the flip trope of where they, you know, say, all right, what do we do? And now the incompetent cops from previous are the ones with the fully fleshed out plan. Get him while we have the element of surprise. Let's go, go, go. And he's like, yeah, yeah, what he said. And he goes in and he
gets knocked right out
goes
the
straight
window.
He goes flying straight through the window, and he's fighting Lurch. And the rest of them go for the rest of the mini bosses, as you pointed it out.
Yeah, because they go up against the guys who are throwing knives, and there's no way they have that much cutlery. And it's just like constantly throwing knives. Constant. And they're just chucking butcher stuff, and you know, they hit the bolognese and it explodes, and he's like, no, Andy, no, and he's like, it's okay, it's just bolognese. And so
it's one of my favorite lines too, two blokes on an F load of cutlery. I enjoy that. And then yeah, the he thinks his friend got hit in the face with a knife and he's bleeding, so he goes firing like crazy.
Now there is a bananas montage of close-up shots here, where you're cutting back and forth from, not just from both vantage points of these people fighting here in this scene, but also between Simon Pegg and Lurch fighting in another area of the convenience store. So you have close-ups of each of these characters fighting close-ups of each of these characters, and things are in motion, and it could very easily just be complete mush, but it has some structure to it still, so it reads as chaos, but you can tell how the battle in each location is progressing. So I still like this part.
Yeah, it's still some pretty competent action in spite of the chaos.
Yeah, and so he knocks him out in the cooler.
There's that nice pause where he looks and stares at him, where he could say something cool, but he doesn't.
Yes, and then Nick Frost points that out later on, and because he's so disappointed. And
I love the way he comes sliding into that too. He does like a full spin on his knees as he slides with his back up against the freezer.
Yes, and he slides in right next to Nick Frost. They catch up on that and what's happening, and then they form up their plan of getting the meat cleaver guys with the thing of the shopping trolleys, as they say, to go act as a battering ram, and they give themselves cover by firing at the guys who are hiding behind the meat counter so they can't throw anything. They break the case, and this apparently prevents them from using knives.
It's great because it's a ridiculous action movie trope where they make this battering ram out of carts, but it doesn't even matter if it works or not because they don't even bother to pay that off. They just hit the case, and I guess we're supposed to assume that like it shoved them back up against a wall and knocked them out or something, but it doesn't matter. We don't show it.
Yeah, and so they're deactivated, for lack of a better term, and then we have the lady who comes screaming up, the assistant who works part-time as a table dancer, and she's got her little utility knife, and she's gonna stab people up. And this is when Doris takes the wet floor sign and smacks her across the face with it, and knocking her out cold. And one of the Andes says, "Nice one, Doris." And she says, "Nothing like a little girl on girl," because that's all she's been doing is innuendo this whole entire movie. And so finally, you know, even if you're like, all this innuendo is pretty terrible, this one you kind of laugh at because she competently executed her job. So good job, Doris.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Doris is great.
And so they go into the back office, but he's made his way out of there, and he's in the police car with Jim Broadbent, and so they go jump out to go after him into the refuse bin that's down there, into the dumpster, which is full of not sharp, pointy, painful things, but just cardboard and
padding and cardboard. Yeah.
and some trash bags full of foam. So they land softly enough. They get into their car and go chasing off after them. This is when they have their car chase out of town and they come across the swan. They freak out and go, swan, and then they swerve out and then they smash through the railing on the side of the road and they go over the model village, which is sitting there, and there's one kid who is in the model village with a map of the model village looking looking through.
It's Aaron A. Aronson.
Yes, which is hilarious because it's a callback to the phone book. And they, you know, you want us to go through everybody in the phone book? And so the car goes flying in slow motion over this whole model city, which is such a ridiculous shot that I love it. And they come up after where they had swerved off, and they see the swan. And they also go, swan. They slam on the brakes, get the swan into the car, put it in the back seat, and then they go jump off after them into the same area. But they didn't flip their car, so they're still okay. Now, Jim Broadbent and Timothy Dalton are a little worse for wear from this little run, but Simon Pegg and Timothy Dalton, you know, go to their fisticuffs. And what's funny is the he's holding a gun that gets knocked out of his hand by Timothy Dalton, and it goes sliding into the little tiny version of the Summerfield shopping mart mall and breaks the front of it, which is his market. So I like the poeticness of that.
It's a nice touch. And I think this is one part of the commentary that I found particularly entertaining is that they were talking about how, like, the only way for this to get even bigger than life than it was before is, like, to make the characters, like, literally Godzilla-sized stomping around the town, which, of course, he couldn't do, which would be insane. So he made a smaller version of the town for them to stomp around in.
Which is absolutely absurd and hilarious. And there's all the stuff where you're, like, catching somebody's punch and, like, pushing back on them. And then, like, no, you're down. You're almost down for the count. And then you caught their punch, and now you're really, like, pushing back really hard. And it's like, this isn't really how people fight.
It's the super cop thing, man. He's getting beat, but then all of a sudden he catches the punch, and he's got all the energy now, and the tables have turned, and he's going to beat him.
I mean, I love it because it's playing on the trope.
It's the tropiest of tropes, but poking fun at it at the same time. It's so great.
Yeah, it's very funny. And then he, you know, whoops him. And this is unfortunately where somebody has to take it on the chin, and he gets skewered.
Yeah. And he goes to check on Aaron A. Aronson, and then, of course, Timothy Dalton wakes up and starts charging at him with a box cutter, but he like, step on a little model of a bus or something, and he just goes flying.
Yeah, and then the bottom of his jaw goes through the little spike thing, and it comes out through his mouth. And then he's just like, oh, it really hurts.
I'm going to need a lot of ice cream. He's like, yeah, we got plenty of that at the station. Whip pan over to
Nick
Frank
Frost
and Danny.
Yeah, and he's got his dad. Only his dad's got him because he takes his gun out of his holster. And, you know, he's like, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't shoot him. You know, you did all this for him. You love him. And he's like, blah, 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 blah. And then he gets into his car and he goes to drive away. Unfortunately, the swan is in the back and hisses and bites him and he drives into the tree.
Well, you can't miss the Point Break moment where he like goes to shoot Simon Pegg and Danny tries to wrestle the gun away from him and he gets it. He's going to shoot his dad, but he can't because he loves him so much. So he just shoots up in the air and goes,
Yes.
And yeah, he steals the car and he gets attacked by the swan because he's a jerk and the swan likes the not jerky characters because, you know, we've reached the part in the movie where the swan has picked sides and it the swan is on the side of the good guys.
Yeah. Or the swan would have just bit them if they waited around the car long enough earlier. But so anyway, this concludes that. The London guys come in. They clean this whole thing up and they, you know, want him back.
With the slow motion, low angle shot of the helicopter flying over top too.
It was hilarious.
Just like Bad Boys 2.
Yes. And just like Bad Boys 2. And they have this conversation where they want to have him come back to London because since he's gone, the numbers have gotten a little squidgy or squoofy or what. I can't remember what he said, but the numbers are not good because he was doing like 400% of the arrests at the beginning of the film. So they're not succeeding as well without him. So in spite of the fact that he makes the rest of them look bad, they would like to have him around so that they don't fail. And he's not sure he wants to do that anymore because he's got his town now. He's got his mission. He's got his purpose.
Plus, he's got a substantial amount of paperwork he's got to take care of after all of that nonsense.
Yep. And
which is hilarious that they actually cut to like the police station where everyone is just sitting around filling out endless paperwork with their hands in pain.
Yeah, because I mean, there would be a lot of paperwork. And now, do you want to detail the explosive ending of this?
Sure, of course. So just when you think it's all hunky-dory and they've captured the bad guys and everyone's just filling out paperwork and oh, how hilarious. Turns out the old guy for the NWA who runs the video cameras, who has the office in the police station, was in there all along. And he comes out with a ridiculous, like, 18th century blunderbuss and he wants to shoot Simon Pegg because he's a damn busybody is what he calls him. And then Danny dives in front of him and takes a bullet for him, and Simon Pegg flicks a trash can into the face of the old NWA guy, who goes falling backwards through the evidence room on top of the sea mine, which sort of like rolls over a little bit, trapping him underneath, but also pushing in one of its little spikes and arming itself and blowing him and the entire station to pieces everywhere.
Yeah. And then
that's the end of that guy.
He's not coming back for the sequel. And so they have the whole thing with the, you know, oh, you know, don't die and blah, 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 back and forth with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg.
Because even though the whole building blew up, yeah, Nick Frost is like laying on a pile of bricks, like over.
He's got some dirty makeup
out,
on.
Like bleeding from his stomach.
Dirty makeup. That means he was in an explosion. And so yeah. They have the whole exchange there, and then they do the fake out about, you know, seeing a tombstone and the flowers.
Oh yeah, because it's 1 year later all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm. Because that's important. I would like to point out that I feel like the movie should have probably ended a little earlier than this, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let's just get through this. So the tombstone, of course, has Butterman, and that's the only part of it you can see. Oh no, is it going to be Nick Frost? Of course it isn't. Nick Frost is next to him, and he's you know, got the flowers, and they put it down on the thing, and it's Irene Butterman, who went loopy and committed suicide when the town had originally failed to live up to the Best Town of the Year award. So they pay their respects to her, and then they get out of there, and they've got the souped up police car, and they do like little donuts and stuff, and they're spinning around, and they're gonna go after the people.
Yeah, because he's officially the lunatic super cop that he was railing against the entire movie, wearing his leather gloves with his toothpick, speeding around town to go, I don't know, what was the call? It was something about like somebody rooting around through somebody's trash or something.
Yeah, somebody's recycling bin.
So he's gonna flip a 180 and spin the tires and charge over there because he's now officially, I don't know, Sylvester Stallone or something.
Hilarious. So they get through. And then as they get out of the town, there's the whole thing with the logo wipes across, and it's the HF and, you know, Hot Fuzz. There you go. Police. End of the movie.
It's a good movie.
It's a really good movie. I really like it.
We probably discussed like 20% of what actually happens in this movie.
Well, it's so dense. And that's also part of the problem was I was trying to economize. We definitely skipped over some things.
There's like even on its merits, the plot is entertaining, but then every little piece that connects every other little piece is just super enjoyable.
Yeah, so when you're mad that we didn't talk about your favorite part, just go watch the movie again, and then, you know,
yeah,
chill.
This podcast should only serve as a reminder to you that this movie is so good that you should go watch it again right now.
This is your bookmark that the movie is good enough for you to go watch. Like, we have no extended metadata here.
Yeah. So if you've we should have done this at the beginning of the episode. So just delete this podcast. Go watch the movie. Well, don't delete it yet. So watch the movie. Listen to the Edgar Wright, Quentin Tarantino commentary, and then delete this podcast. Then you'll be done.
Yes.
So it's the right order of things, right? Where you do you lick the salt and then do the tequila and then the lime thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Edgar Wright's ever going to do a time travel movie?
What? Has he?
I don't think he has.
What?
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Maybe. I mean, there's enough futury weirdness in The World's End that I think he would be up for that. I really wish he would have done Ant-Man. Not that Ant-Man's a bad movie, but like to see him put his spin on something like that would have been so good.
Well, I still haven't seen it, so I'll take your word for it.
It's fine. It's on par with like the first Iron Man-ish.
Yeah, everybody says it's good. It's not like blow your socks off good, but they said it was one of the better Superman. So, but of the better superhero movies that were released that was released that year.
It's totally an adequate movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's fine.
All right.
Paul Rudd worked.
Okay. What about Michael Douglas?
He was good. He was Michael Douglas. He had some CG in the beginning of the movie to make him look like younger Michael Douglas.
Did you like all the Lola work on his face to make him look like 1980s Michael Douglas?
He looked like a very nice CG representation of what Michael Douglas looked like in the 80s. No, it was pretty good work, but I could see it.
Okay. Nothing gets past you, Dan.
Nah, no, I'm too sharp.
Yes, yes. Unless they go beyond 270 degrees, then they get past you.
Right. Yeah. If you go beyond 270 degrees, you're gonna have a
271 degrees.
Right. 271 degrees. You're gonna have a 400-pound Fisher dolly buried in some snow, which is not fun. You know, when they invented those dollies, they're hydraulic. They were originally built to put bombs onto fighter jets.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's where the technology came from. And then they transitioned into camera dollies.
Fascinating.
Yeah, they're good stuff. I like dollies.
Just like playing with your dollies?
Oh, man, I wish I could have one. You're not allowed to just buy them.
Oh. So it was a rental?
Yeah, you're only allowed to lease them. And even you have to like qualify for a lease. Like they just don't let anybody lease them if you just feel like it.
Oh, so this is like when Lexus released the LFA or whatever, and you had to pre-qualify, and they do like investigative reporting on you in order to see that you were guaranteed to have it?
Something like that. It's a little bit more like Panavision, where they're like, oh, our stuff is so fancy, we don't have to sell it. Or like that really expensive camera that they used to shoot The Revenant, which was really hard to shoot.
I have heard that somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of snow in this movie, which is good. This movie's good.
Yes.
Don't go see The Revenant. Go watch Hot Fuzz again. It's shorter and way better.
I think that's abundantly clear. We have also talked about The Revenant, and we also had unpleasant things to say about it for a very long period of time. But I would like to end this on a happy note and just say that I really like this movie, and that I apologize about our ineptitude in discussing it, but we're just so enthusiastic that we wanted to get to it and say yay.
This movie's too good. There's no way we could cover all of it. It's great. No. Edgar Wright's great. He's a very talented director. I would like to see more things from him, hopefully soon. He's doing something right now, isn't he? Didn't he just tweet he's like on set or something?
I have no idea.
What is he shooting? He's shooting a movie called Baby Driver. I don't know what that is.
Okay.
That's John Hammond, apparently, and Kevin Spacey. And Jamie Foxx? What? What is this? After being coerced into working for a crime boss, a young getaway driver finds himself taking part in a heist doomed to fail. Huh. Okay, then.
Okay. Did you ever see Don't?
Look forward to that. Don't? What is that?
Edgar Wright's contribution Don't was produced in the style of a 1970s Hammer House of Horror film trailer. Blah, 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 blah. With Jason Isaacs, Matthew McFadden. I've never heard of it before. I was just looking through on his thing. Never heard of it. Peter Serafinowicz, Will Arnett, Mark Gatiss, Nick Frost. So a lot of people in it for a thingy. So he must have enjoyed that, I guess.
Mm. Oh, yeah. And just to reiterate, you say this is your favorite of the, for those who don't know, the Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, World's End. How do you rank those? Hot Fuzz still on top? Where do the other two land?
Hot Fuzz on top, World's End, and then Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, I think I'm probably the same way too. Which is weird though, because you don't want to say like Shaun of the Dead is bad. It's like the least good, but it's still a fantastic movie. It's still so much better than so many other movies.
Yeah, Shaun of the Dead has a really great start. I think that's what I love most about it is the way that Shaun of the Dead begins. And we've already discussed the movie, so I'm not going to retread it, but. I just feel like it doesn't hold up overall as well as the other films do. And at World's End, I feel like things started really kind of falling apart as you went along because there were so many things that were in motion. Now, in Hot Fuzz, there are so many things in motion, but they kind of weave back together that it doesn't really feel as fall aparty as
World's End. Although the one thing that I think the World's End does a lot better than this one is all of the the little Edgar Wright-isms that you see early on in the movie, the themes that he weaves in the beginning that come back to pay off at the end or are re-referenced at the end. There are a ton more of them in The World's End, especially, you know, all the names and numbers of all of the pubs and stuff. And all of that stuff is used super well. Like, there's not a wasted ounce of art department or writing or anything in that movie. It's just so good.
Yeah, it's just slightly less appealing to me than this.
Mm-hmm.
But
the very end of the movie still kind of baffles me.
I don't understand that choice. But like I said, you know, as just a couple minutes ago, I don't necessarily understand why we didn't end the movie a little earlier than we did for Hot Fuzz.
It's like Bad Boys 2. You gotta have a third act after your third act.
Yeah, I just felt like it just didn't need as many little like fake out endings. I thought that it would have been okay if we had just tied a bow on it a little earlier. And I know it's making a reference to like the fake outs of, oh no, it's not really over, oh no, maybe they're dead, blah blah blah, but
wait, there's more.
Yeah, I kind of wanted it to be just tied off a little sooner. Like, it could have been fine when he said like, oh no, this is my town, and then I would have been okay with that. And then it could have been fine right after the mine explosion and he's like, oh no, and then just say that he's okay in the same scene and then he's glad that he's okay and that's it, and you end the movie. And then it's really the extending it to the graveyard scene, and it's just like, okay, a year later, like we needed this title card right now. The movie's about almost over. You're going to end now? No, now we have the car scene. It's just like,
well, it's all basically the same thing. The 1 year later is to show that he has become the psychotic super cop that we always knew he could be.
Yeah. Well, I just wish that it was a little more, felt like a singular ending. You get what I mean? For like narrative wise, like just like,
I think it all makes sense narrative wise.
No, it makes sense. It's just like, just tie it off. We're done here. If it just felt like, and then you're like, no.
You finished off the plot, but then you didn't finish off the story of Nicholas Angel.
Well, we're never going to finish off the story of Nicholas Angel because presumably he goes on to do other things in this town for the rest of his life.
I know, but he became the tyrannical cop butterfly from the Caterpillar. He blossomed in Sanford.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Tyrannical butterfly.
Blossoming.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very floral faunal there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a greenhouse in here. I am so hot and sweaty in this office right now.
Okay, we're ending the thing now. we're discussing bodily functions. So we're done.
I mean, it's just sweating. It's like an involuntary bodily function.
I know, but the part that's voluntary is ending the podcast. Ta-da! Oh, I forgot to mention, when last week we talked about Judge Judy as Judge Dredd, and in this movie there's specifically a line, Judge Judy and Executioner.
It's not Judge Judy and Executioner. Yeah, that's pretty good.
I like that. Yeah.
Dear. Edgar Wright, he's a good writer.
Yep. It's a good thing they have it in his name.
Edgar Wrighter.
Yeah.